Why do the bulldozers use like the isochore samples to sort of justify their positions? I heard, like, you know, Andy Hedegraaff, you know, the
correct.
Yeah, he pulled to the old curve right. view, and he's saying, I think I heard him say something about isochores, and that's why I was interested in your talk today.
Right.
I was wondering why what they see in that that's different than what.
Well, first of all, he has developed a whole different paradigm than what we believe. We don't just use evidence for the Ice Age as justifying a young Earth. We've done all kinds of studies, for example, the Ray Project, which was referred to earlier, which has to do with radioisotopes in the age of the Earth, and a whole bunch of different studies as well. So we're convinced young Earth creationists as opposed to his position, which, by the way, Hank Pantograph came to the Lord through the ministry of ICR, and for quite a while he was a young Earth creationist, but then changed his viewpoint. But that's the basic reason why he looks at it differently. There are also some other issues. The ice cores really still have not been adequately studied and explained, although I've tried to understand them and explain them in a young Earth creationist perspective. There are still some issues that need to be resolved. For example, for quite a while, we were able to argue that the ice cores could have accumulated in the young Earth time frame because we didn't have very good evidence below maybe 1,000 years of the data from the ice cores. But in the last 15 or 20 years, there's more and more evidence, and looking at the ice cores, you can actually see visual layers all the way down to what they have suggested is 150 to 200,000 years, which blows a hole in the idea of a young Earth. However, there are some alternative explanations as to why you see those layers. It turns out that during the Genesis, during the Ice Age, it was also a very chaotic process that instead of explaining these layers as annual layers, you can actually have individual storms that produce that effect that looks like an annual layer. In fact, I've known this myself in working in my research before I got involved in creation research, that when you have a storm comes through, it produces a particular type of ice crystal in the front of the storm, and then after the storm, it changes. Now, it has to do with the type of ice crystals, how much riming they are. I'm getting into the technical details now. But you have what's called rime ice that occurs at the first part of the storm and not afterwards. Well, the assumption by the conventional community is that that transition happened over a year. It happened because the ice was cold in the winter and then it melted in the spring and it formed that little layer. Well, if it occurs on each storm, which could have occurred every 3 or 4 days instead of over a year, that compresses that time frame dramatically. So he hasn't considered that. So, but if you take the conventional explanation, he's justified in his position. I don't think it's correct, though. So that gets really technical in a hurry. I had one graduate student doing nothing but working on that particular problem. And he made quite a bit of progress, but we still need more. We need more graduate students to work in this area, for one thing. Another question. Yes, sir.
Is there evidence of an ice-free area where the people lived up like
I'm having a hard time hearing you say.
Is there evidence of an ice-free area in the Middle East somewhere live?
Yes, oh yeah, that didn't get ice there. There was no ice in the deserts of the Middle East. But there appears evidence from the work that I've done on computer modeling that during the period when we had an ice age in the northern or in the more away from the equator, closer to the poles, where we were having an ice age, in the tropics, it was still raining quite a bit. Not that much rain, but it kept it moist so that the what were deserts today was relatively covered with vegetation and so on because there was a lot more rain. That eventually went away. And one of the studies I did showed that some of the typhoons that developed in the Arabian Sea were generated by this process all over the Middle East. And that's a complete study in itself that I did. And that was really fascinating because it changes our viewpoint. You remember in Scripture where it talks about the Israel being the land filled with honey and milk and honey. Milk and honey. It also talks about when you look down from the northern part of the Sea of Galilee down to the southern part, it's green all the way down to Zoar. Well, it's not that way today, except where it's irrigated. It appears that early on, after the flood, the whole Middle East, not just Israel, but the whole Middle East, was not yet desert, and it dried out and continued to become desert today. But other than on the mountains, like there's a glacier even on top of Mount, what's the one there in Lebanon? Mount Hermon. That has ice and snow. They ski there. People go up there in the winter and go skiing. It's not a permanent glacier. But in the past, that would have been a lot more. In fact, if you read in the book of Job talks a lot about ice and snow and so on. It's the only book that talks about that. Well, that was one of the oldest books in the Bible, if not the oldest. And it probably was because there was ice and snow around in the mountains there, even in the Middle East, but not down in the lower elevations. That one is really fascinating. When Noah came off out of the ark, he didn't just migrate into an area that was desert. For a long time, the valleys there were green and fertile, primarily because there was still a lot of water in the soil coming down after the flood, but there was also continuing rain and snow in the mountains of that area. And so the valleys, the water came down into the valleys and kept that very fertile. So it's a little different than we would automatically think when Noah came off the ark, he immediately went into a desert. He didn't. It was very fertile for a long time. Other questions? Yes, sir.
I never thought of it before when you showed that picture of cloud and then it would cover the entire earth, is what you're saying.
Yes, because there was much more moisture, because there was warm oceans providing a lot of vapor that drifted over to the continents, and so you'd have a lot of cloud from that. In addition, because there were so many volcanoes spewing out smoke and dust and all kinds of stuff, that would produce more what are called cloud nuclei that would produce more cloud, and it would cause more haze in the atmosphere. So it was cloudy, not just water cloud, but dust clouds and all kinds of stuff, particularly, and that would have produced particularly cooling over the continents. You couldn't have had much effect over the ocean because they were so hot, they're so warm, but over the continents that effect would have caused a lot of cooling over the continents. But there would have been cloud everywhere, very heavy cloud.
It also makes me think of how the Neanderthals, if they said about the rickets and so on. So related with the
early, it could be. I think so, because the climate would have been much more cloudy and rainy, kind of like living here. We don't get rickets and stuff. It's not that cloudy. But that may have been more because they were forced to live in caves and they limited on their diet. And many of them may have lived a lot longer than we do for quite a while after the flood. So there's a number of factors that could have affected that. Yes, sir.
You mentioned the effects of the heated water in the ocean on the fish.
I didn't, but that's a very interesting question. People are concerned that if the ocean is as hot as I'm suggesting, that it would kill all the fish. Well, first of all, it did kill a lot of fish. That's the largest number of fossils that we find in the layers anywhere, is the marine fossils. However, it didn't kill them all. And the reason would be that near where the sources of heat were would be the hottest, and near the continents where there was ice and snow melting and rain coming off the continents, it would have cooled the surface layers at least. Not only the heat would have been less there, and that would have been able to preserve many of the fish, but it also provided less salty water. It's likely that before the flood, the oceans were not nearly as salty as they are today. The processes of the flood contributed a tremendous amount of salt to the oceans through all these catastrophic processes, but and the fish would have had to have some time to adapt. And they could have done that because freshwater fish would have had water coming from the rivers. And it turns out that freshwater floats on top of salt water. So fresh, warm water floats on top. And so the fish could have escaped the salty water and really hot water by getting close to the mouths of rivers and up near the surface. So there was, I think, all kind and further away from the mid-ocean ridges. You know, they're out in the middle of the ocean. So it may well be that there was quite a variation of temperature and salinity that allowed for that. Now, that's my hypothetical idea. The Bible doesn't say that. We don't have a lot of evidence from science to support that. It's modeling and hypothetical. But that's my view on it. That's a good question. I've always liked that one. Okay, how about one more? Yes, sir.
I wanted to ask about the biblical timeline, which is the 6,000 years, and the conventional timeline, which goes back to millions of years.
Billions.
My question is, how reliable are these dating methods? Because the scientists are using some method of dating, and the non-Christian secular scientists are also using a method of dating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I know there's been some reports, results that you wrote from the great research. So my question is, how reliable are those dating methods?
Well, that's the reason we did that project. Give you a little history. I don't want to give a whole lecture, obviously, but I'll give you a real taste of it. First, let me do it before I do that, forget and say it. The results are reported in a technical, two-volume technical series called Radioisotopes in the Age of the Earth, the final results of the RATE project. Now, that's basically intended for scientists and engineers, people who have a strong technical background. But there, it's also been written up in a book called Billions, Thousands, Not Billions, written by Don DeYoung, who is a well-known writer, and he was part of the team that reported on this project. And so I would recommend those of you might be interested in those two sources. But basically, we started that because we recognized that this is really probably the crux of the strongest piece of evidence for an old Earth is radioisotopes, the data that comes from all these various processes using radioisotopes. And so we felt we had to address this. And I put together a team of eight scientists, and all of them had PhDs in various fields of geology and geophysics and physics and astronomy and so on. They had impeccable credentials. Some came from Los Alamos National Lab, Sandia National Lab, and various universities. And they all came together on a team, and we spent 8 years working on this project, in which we put together a proposal saying, this is a problem for young Earth creationists, we need to address it. We put together a plan for how to approach it, and we were actually going to raise money to do the kind of research that's done in the conventional scientific community. And over the period of the project, we basically raised and used $2 million to do the science to support this. And what we basically came up with, that there was some major problems with radiometric techniques, that there were some logic problems and there was some data problems that had not been addressed properly. And I don't have time to go into that, but let me give you an illustration of one of these, and I would recommend that you go to the books if you really want to get into this more. One, for example, which we didn't really intend to do as part of the project originally, but we found out that the conventional scientific community had been looking at carbon-14 for about 10 years, and we were unaware of it. And they had developed a new tool, a spectrometer, that allowed them to look at extremely small quantities carbon-14 in coal. And they did the analysis, and they kept coming up with carbon-14, which they should not have, because carbon-14 decays very rapidly. And if coal is on the order of 100 million years old, which is the standard view of how old coal is, there should be no carbon-14 left in it. Well, they kept finding it. Well, this violated the whole idea that the coal was old. So they had gone through and reported on 70 different experiments to try to explain where the carbon-14 was coming from. And they never did have an explanation for it. Well, we went back and repeated the same experiments that they did and basically showed that the carbon-14 is there. It's really there. So that implies that coal is young. Now, there was a problem with it because coal can be contaminated. It's in the ground. You can get water seeping down and contaminate it. So one of our scientists, Dr. Baumgartner, who was retired from Los Alamos National Labs, a world-respected geophysicist, said, well, you know, if coal has carbon-14 in it, how about diamonds? Diamonds is carbon also, and it should have some carbon-14 in it also if it's young. So it took us almost 3 years to do this experiment because you had to get diamonds and crush them up and put them in a machine, a furnace, to burn the diamond in order to get the carbon-14 out. We kept blowing up furnaces. We did this under contract to some labs, and they kept blowing the furnaces up. They finally developed a technique, and they tested for carbon-14 in diamond, and they found carbon-14, saying that the diamonds are young, not just coal. But the importance about diamonds is that it's the hardest substance known to man, and you cannot contaminate a diamond. And so we found irrefutable evidence that diamonds are young. Now, we had this and three other major experiments. That's just an illustration of one of them, which is one of the easier to understand. We reported this at the American Geophysical Union meeting in San Francisco back in 2003. And it's kind of a fluke that we were able to do this. It turns out that 2003 was a 100-year anniversary of the discovery of radioactivity. And so they were looking for unique ideas to present in the session at the American Geophysical Union meeting. And we said, hey, we got some unique ideas. And they accepted our papers, which we presented in a poster session, as it's called. And we had something like 40 of the major labs, the heads of various labs, conventional labs, come by and look at our result, scratch their head, and say, this can't be. There's no way that this can be. And a number of them went back and repeated the same experiments we had done and found the same results that we did. Now, this has influenced the conventional community, but we don't know quite how because they don't want to talk about it. So we don't know what they're going to do with it or what they have done with it completely, but we know that from the feedback we've got that it has had an influence. So anyway, that's a long answer to a question, but it gives you a taste of what we were doing. It's not just a fly-by-night thing. And to me, this was, and all the team that we put together, we all viewed this is the peak of our career. I mean, this was the most important project we ever did. And the Lord blessed in raising, can you believe, $2 million from his people to do this science project? Because they recognized the importance of that particular question.
Yeah.